I think one of the key issues that we have also discussed is how the COVID-19 pandemic has revealed ongoing issues of inequity and injustice, both in public health responses to the pandemic, but also in the deployment of vaccines. And we would argue then that social scientists and the work that we do can take a strong political position to address these injustices and these inequity by providing empirical evidence for the impact of politics, economics, and history on vaccine deployment.
Hello, and welcome to EpiCast, a podcast series about epidemics from Sonar Global, a social science network funded by the European Commission. The aim of these podcasts are to explore the social dimensions of infectious disease outbreaks so we can get better at managing them. My name is Megan Schmitzane, and I'm a researcher at the Institute of Development Studies. Welcome to today's episode. Today, we will explore the political, economic, and social aspects of vaccine deployment and administration, and deepen our understanding of vaccine uptake. This is a timely topic. Every day, we see news reporting about COVID-19 vaccination disparities and low confidence, particularly among some groups in areas where vaccines are readily available. In the U.S., President Biden just announced a series of measures and mandates to improve vaccination rates. Simultaneously, we are facing a crisis of COVID-19 vaccine apartheid, where maps of percentage vaccinated show us stark differences in vaccine access, particularly between the global north and sub-Saharan Africa. We discussed this in our last episode. Today, we'll discuss another aspect of vaccination, the context of vaccine deployment. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we have seen low vaccine confidence, largely framed in terms of misinformation and conspiracy theories. However, this focus on individual attitudes can be taken out of context. Social scientists have long been saying that vaccine attitudes are about more than hesitation to accept a particular vaccine. There's a wider context of underlying distrust in governments, rumors and misinformation, and system weaknesses that fracture vaccine access. In other words, this is a social crisis, not simply a biomedical one. It is also imperative that we learn from excellent work being done by social scientists on other kinds of vaccines, vaccination programs, and vaccine deployment. It's imperative that we learn from successes in the global south and apply that learning to COVID-19 response. Today, we will hear from a number of experts working in diverse contexts under Project AVID, or the Anthropological Exploration of Facilitators and Barriers to Vaccine Deployment and Administration During Disease Outbreaks, led by Professor Shelley Lees at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Let's get started. Hi, Shelley. Hi, everyone. I'm really glad to have you here today. Let's start with some introductions, if you don't mind.
I am Shelley Lees. I'm a medical anthropologist based at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And my role on this project is the principal investigator.
Hi, I'm Alex Bauer. I'm a research fellow in medical anthropology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and I am the Uganda case study lead.
Hi there, my name is Teresa Jones. I'm a senior research associate with Anthropologica, and I led the lessons learned exercise for the AVID project.
Hi, I'm Luisa Enria. I'm an assistant professor at the London School, and my role on the project is I'm the case study lead for Sierra Leone.
Hi, I'm Sam Vanderslot. I'm a health sociologist at the Oxford Vaccine Group at the University of Oxford, and I'm the India case study lead.
Hi, I'm Clarissa Simas. I'm a research fellow at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and I led the Brazil case study of our project.
Hi, I'm Lee Salcana-Stevens. I'm a visiting postdoctoral researcher at Harvard University, and I'm leading the case study on the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
I'm Mark Marchant. I'm a PhD student and research fellow at LSHTM, and I was the community engagement lead on the AVID project.
Thank you. It's nice to speak with you all. So I wanted to start with you, Shelley. I wanted to ask, What led to this project idea and how did this all become a reality?
Yes, thanks, Megan. So this actually was a response to a specific call by the National Institute of Health Research grants, who were looking for applications for research, anthropological research on vaccine deployment during epidemics. Initially, we met together to discuss the research we've been conducting on vaccine development and how that could inform a study on vaccine deployment. Many of our team who will be talking today have been working on Ebola vaccine trial research. And we found that participant and local community views reflected experiences of the Ebola epidemic more broadly. And we thought that drawing on that, we could develop a study around vaccine deployment. For the Ebola vaccine trials, we learned that whilst the vaccines were in an experimental phase, we were interested in how the communities would accept the rollout of the vaccines during an Ebola epidemic. For example, for the Ebola vaccine, we were interested to understand how communities would accept strategies that only vaccinated some people in the community, such as the ring vaccination, which was conducted in DRC and Guinea more recently. So drawing on that, this formed our first case study in Sierra Leone, working with Louisa, who will be talking about that case study a bit later. Through further discussions, I was put in contact with Sam, Alex, Lise, and Clarissa, and we discussed more broadly exploring vaccine deployment in the context that they had been working in, and they'll discuss that a bit later.
Thank you so much. It sounds like you're taking a much broader look at vaccine deployment. And so it will be exciting to hear from the others about how that's worked in different country contexts. So the other unique aspect of this project, from my perspective as an outsider, is this anthropological approach. So why do you think that was needed and what kind of gaps were you seeing in vaccine deployment?
Yeah, I mean, as anthropologists, we conduct in-depth long-term research in very specific contexts. And this call asked us to look at anthropological research around vaccine deployment. We decided that taking a case study approach would allow us to explore different contexts, different emergence diseases and different vaccines, and therefore bring those case studies together to think about this much more holistically. Our key questions across the case studies is how our learning could contribute to knowledge about political and economic perspectives, healthcare system response, vaccine hesitancy and confidence, and as Alex will discuss in his project, One Health perspectives. Finally, we also thought using a case study approach, it would be important to engage our research communities in the research and to gather lessons learned about engaging communities in research, which Mark and Teresa will be discussing later.
Thank you so much, Shelley. So now I wanted to hear from each one of the case study leads. Let's start with you, Louisa. What are the key issues related to vaccine development in Sierra Leone, and what is the context of vaccine deployment?
Yes, thanks. I'll talk a little bit about the Sierra Leone case study and maybe give you a little bit briefly of a background as to what we're doing with that case study, which I think already kind of starts painting a picture of what the context is. So we, as Shelley's already mentioned, we'd been working in Sierra Leone for a few years on the Ebola vaccine trials and working really closely together with public health officials at the Cambia District Health Management Team. And so through that collaboration, those experiences, we decided that alongside kind of looking at the experiences and perspectives of vaccine development during the Ebola outbreak, it was also important to kind of think about the other side, I guess, so what are the sort of political, economic, and just broadly sort of structural factors that make it possible or make it difficult to deploy vaccines during an emergency, but then sort of throughout the project, that we realized that also had to mean looking at deployment of vaccines, of routine vaccination as well. And I think the context very briefly for Sierra Leone, which I think is the case for probably all the case studies, has been changing drastically over the last few years. So when we started, what was really relevant was sort of lessons from the Ebola outbreak and how they were being institutionalized to some extent, or especially at district level. There were attempts to kind of set up some preparedness infrastructures and new ways of thinking about how to do vaccine deployment during an emergency alongside other response activities. But then obviously over the last year and a half, we've also, the context that's been really significant has also been COVID-19 and how the district health management team has tried to respond to COVID, tried to set up a COVID vaccine deployment process, as well as a new Ebola vaccine deployment process when the outbreak in Guinea started. So that's sort of the context, I guess, that we've been working in.
Thank you, Louisa. That's really interesting to hear about the structural factors that make it possible to deploy vaccines during an epidemic, particularly at the district level. Could you actually talk a little bit more about the political economy?
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to highlight a couple of the key issues that came out of that research that we were doing on the political and economic factors of vaccine deployment off the back of or kind of following the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone. And I think what was sort of really interesting for us was looking at the kind of day-to-day process of deploying vaccines at a district level. And I think that the kind of interesting issues range from kind of big picture questions around, you know, the challenges of emergency financing, for example, and how difficult it is to sort of sustain proper resourcing for epidemic response and preparedness in a place like Cambia. But then also kind of at micro level, at the sort of peripheral health unit level, for example, a lot of our findings were kind of highlighting the challenges of how much the local health system relies on volunteer labor, for example, to collect and deliver vaccines, and how difficult that can be in terms of kind of, again, sort of sustaining a routine vaccination, as well as kind of issues with calculating supply requirements, for example, in border areas. So these kind of really kind of bread and butter issues, I guess, of vaccine deployment. But one thing that was interesting, and this kind of ties up to findings in other case studies as well, is that despite all of these structural challenges, a lot of the district's focus continued to be on questions and concerns around potentially resistant communities. And in particular, kind of concerns and discussions at the district level about what to do about a lack of knowledge, for example, or assumed lack of knowledge within communities. And perhaps that's because it's an easier thing to address than the kind of much deeper structural issues. But what our perspective allowed us to do, to kind of working alongside the district health management team and also bringing together this kind of questions of vaccine confidence with questions of vaccine access, like other case studies have done, is that we were able to kind of see these things holistically and kind of put them in conversation with each other. And so we've kind of, some of the follow-on work that we've done with the DHMT has been, for example, to train community health workers to do research in their communities, so that they could highlight some of the, so they could understand a little bit what some of the daily challenges were in border areas in particular, so that then you could kind of stimulate a conversations about what constraints there were at district level, at peripheral health unit level, and then at community level in terms of kind of bringing access and demand issues in the same conversation.
Thank you. So Clarissa, what were you looking at in the Brazil case study and what did you learn?
Hi, yes, sure. So the same as it happened with Louisa, it's the goals of the case study in itself and how we went about it changed considerably from 2018 to now. But the initial idea was to try to understand maternal vaccine confidence following the Zika outbreak that happened in Brazil around 2016. So the idea was to focus on the follow-up of that outbreak, especially given that there were quite a few rumors that actually the microcephaly was being caused by vaccines at that stage. So that was our initial idea. But then as time passed, we realized that Zika was actually inserted in a much broader context, in a context of complex emergencies or syndemics. So it wasn't just the Zika outbreak that was an issue, but it was also chikungunya, dengue. And in the middle of that, in March 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic happened, and that also added to the complexity of all the emergencies going on. So the idea then, we reshaped our focus to explore maternal vaccine confidence in this context of many syndemics happening. So post-Zika outbreak, current COVID-19 pandemic, and everything else that was going on, and that impact pregnant women directly in their confidence in vaccines. And we did that through conducting a secondary data analysis of a previous data set that worked as a baseline for vaccine confidence for pregnant women in Brazil. And then we followed up trying to understand what are the impacts for that group now in the COVID-19 pandemic. And as I'm sure everyone knows here, Brazil, it's having a very hard time now with the third wave. And we recently recorded 500,000 deaths from COVID-19. And there are a lot of political and economic issues there as well. So especially in terms of supply of vaccines. But of course, at this stage, we cannot discard that the vaccine confidence is also an issue happening in the country. So so that was the idea of this case study, was to explore that a bit more.
Thank you, Clarissa. So, Samantha, what were you looking at in India?
Thanks, Megan. So my case study was about government responses in India to vaccine outbreaks and also the deployment of vaccines for measles and rubella. And I think this was quite a different case study. Actually, as Louisa said, some of these diseases were both endemic and epidemic at the same time. So measles is a disease in India that regularly causes outbreaks. And so I was interested in a particular period of time between 2017 and 18, when a really large state-sponsored measles and rubella vaccine drive had started. And in fact, this vaccine had already been available in India. It'd been licensed, but only private hospitals had been administrating it. And so this was launched with a lot of fanfare, and it was a huge government priority to make sure that this vaccine was made available. But it did come across quite a bit of controversy for what was termed Muslim opposition, and that was represented quite strongly in media discussions and on social media. This is where my methods differed a bit from the other case studies, because I used online media analysis and looked at social media discussions about this vaccine rollout and the associated public discussions and media representation. And through this, I was able to see where blame was being focused upon, and try to unpick what that Muslim opposition was about, how that was characterized, and how the government attempted to overcome it. So what was kind of revealed through the social media discussions, and also doing a bit of historical research and interviews with some key stakeholders, was that this was rooted in a history of really quite long-lasting discriminatory treatment in health services for the Muslim minority in India. We'll go into a bit more of the discussion about how those publics are constructed. And this is something we then worked on together in a joint paper, also with the Sierra Leone case study and Uganda case study, to think about how governments and media construct certain types of vaccinating publics.
Thank you. So over to you, Alex, to hear more about what you were looking at in Uganda.
Absolutely. So with the Uganda case study, we wanted to better understand barriers to vaccine deployment, but we wanted to look at both the veterinary and human sector. Now, a couple of things that we really wanted to engage with was whether negative experiences with veterinary vaccines affected attitudes towards and engagement with human vaccine trials, and also to kind of understand the vice versa. Do experiences with human vaccines affect uptake of livestock vaccination programs? And our data shows there is a clear correlation between that, which I'll talk about later on. But another thing that we wanted to talk about and investigate was the acceptability of a novel One Health vaccine for Rift Valley fever, which is going to be entering into phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials in Uganda. And we really wanted to understand people's attitudes towards a vaccine that's identical for both humans and animals. The way in which we did that was we conducted just under 100 interviews in windy, impenetrable forests, very south Uganda, and in Chemalibwa with the assistance of the Uganda Virus Research Institute and a NGO called Conservation Through Public Health. And we really conducted this study to address a few underlying issues that have been present in Uganda for a while, which is mainly that the veterinary market is currently flooded with untested products, and many of them being vaccines or products claiming to be vaccines. So we wanted to understand what influence that has on health-seeking behaviors, on knowledge of the role of vaccines and kind of their efficacy, and really kind of get to grips with how that influences the construction of local, empirical, and tacit systems of knowledge, which ultimately affect engagement with vaccine campaigns, whether that's in an emergency or that is routine. Again, because vaccines are typically deployed in emergencies in Uganda rather than routinely when it comes to livestock management, there are some hesitations owed to the speed in which vaccines are rolled out, and also because they're relatively new technologies. So we wanted to engage with communities to kind of get their understanding, or at least gather an understanding of kind of vaccine awareness, and whether or not they saw value in these vaccines, and if not, what were they using instead of? And again, the other downside to a novel One Health vaccine being so novel, no, I'll start that again, actually. And don't want negative comments. One of the other things that we also explored was this acceptability of a novel One Health vaccine. And being that it is so new, i.e. the contents are identical for both humans and for animals, we wanted to gauge its acceptability and people's willingness to receive such a vaccine when it is deployed. At the moment, our data suggests that the higher proportion of those interviews were very uncertain, very hesitant towards that. But as I'll explain later on, this data will feed directly back into the development of clinical trials for this Rift Valley fever vaccine, and we will put those communities' perspectives directly into the rollout plans.
Thank you, Alex. It's nice to hear how the data that you're gathering and the information that you're gathering is being integrated into rollout plans to kind of bring in that community perspective. So, Lise, I wanted to ask you about your work in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Thank you. Yeah, so for the case study in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we wanted to explore perceptions of a new unlicensed vaccine being used during an Ebola epidemic. And so to give you a little background, during and following the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, several pharmaceutical companies had been working on an Ebola vaccine. But when Congo declared its ninth outbreak in May 2018 in the western province of Equateur, the only available vaccine was an experimental vaccine developed by the pharmaceutical company Merck, which had been trialed in Sierra Leone and Guinea. And at the time, the vaccine hadn't been approved by any regulatory authority, and so it was deployed under a compassionate use protocol. And it was only targeted populations who were vaccinated. So that was health workers and also people who'd been in direct contact with people potentially infected by the virus. So the first question addressed by our case study was whether the fact that this was an experimental vaccine had any impact on its accessibility among the targeted populations. And so we conducted interviews and ethnographic fieldwork and focus group discussions with around 280 people in the affected villages. So they were people who had received the vaccine, people who hadn't or who had chosen not to, as well as health workers and government officials and traditional healers. And as you can imagine, we found a correlation between a sort of general vaccine hesitancy, so people who didn't participate in routine immunization programs, and hesitancy around the experimental vaccine. But we also found that many people who were happy to take their children to be vaccinated normally were much more skeptical about the Ebola vaccine. And this hesitancy really centered on its experimental nature and on perceptions that it might not be safe, or that Congolese people were being used as guinea pigs to test the safety of the vaccine. And with other new vaccines, people were also concerned about, you know, potential long-term side effects. And so what really became clear to us was that these concerns could have been avoided if communication efforts had focused not only on those being vaccinated, but also on giving information and seeking feedback from the broader population. And then, so when thinking about the broader community, we also have to be really careful to recognize that these populations aren't homogenous. So there are different groups of people who have different priorities and perceptions and concerns. So knowing that unequal social structures, including structural racism and sexism, often produce unequal disease exposure and treatment, we were interested in examining vaccine hesitancy, as well as the barriers to accessing the vaccine in two marginalized populations. So the first of these was women, pregnant and breastfeeding women. And we know that women are often underrepresented in medical trials. So given that this was an unlicensed vaccine, there was a lot of debate about whether pregnant and breastfeeding women who had been exposed to the virus should be offered the vaccine or not. And this actually resulted in these women initially being included in the targeted populations and then later excluded due to safety concerns. So we really wanted to document these inconsistencies and then the effects that they'd had on women who had been vaccinated or who had not been offered vaccination. And then the second group that we really worked with was a minority ethnic group called the Batwa. And we were really interested in issues of trust. We found that Twa communities typically have little trust in biomedicine because for decades they've been marginalized by the health system. So they typically can't afford treatment. There are a few health posts in their villages. And there is a lot of discrimination experienced at biomedical facilities. So what we found was that response teams and vaccination teams were actually using mediators or brokers from the dominant ethnic group whenever they attempted to communicate with Twa communities. And this was really exacerbating mistrust. And what this made clear again was an issue of communication and also that public health initiatives, and especially in emergency situations like epidemics, should not rely on intermediaries, but should instead really work with community leaders and really promote community developed messaging.
So Teresa and Mark, it would be really interesting to hear more about your cross case study perspective. What have you learned? What are you noticing that kind of applies across the case studies about the context of vaccine deployment?
Great. So I think I might just start with give an overview of the learning exercise and some of the key findings. So the AVID project has built in a learning exercise, which has been running in parallel to the rollout of the case studies. Now, this has involved regular check-in interviews with members of the research teams with the aim to provide space for reflection and also to produce useful learning for the overall project and for social scientists working in vaccine deployment. Now, the first topic of the exercise is centered around the application of qualitative methods in diverse settings, with a focus on how the methods selected, be that social media analysis, insider ethnography, focus group discussion, how are they fit for purpose? And that's in terms of addressing the research questions and also producing data that is really useful for vaccine deployment initiatives. Now, with the onset of COVID-19, during the data collection period of most of the case studies, a second key topic has been around how can longer term research pivot and contribute to an active emergency. And a third topic has been around community engagement, which Mark will talk about shortly. Now, one important learning from the exercise has included how AVID's qualitative methods have really interrogated some of those dominant narratives that are used to explain failures in vaccine deployment. Just to give an example of one of these, the issue or problem behind poor vaccine uptake is that members of the public lack knowledge of vaccines. Now, this narrative comes up again and again. Louisa just described it in the context of the Sierra Leone case study. But it isn't always true, or at least it doesn't always give us the full picture. So we've seen that the AVID case studies have used their qualitative methods to go deeper and importantly to shed light on some of the structural and political issues that may in fact be the greater reasons behind poor vaccine uptake. A second learning has been around virtual environments, which have really arisen as an important point because they are increasingly important to understand vaccine confidence and uptake, but they're also becoming more central in social science research as a whole, especially in the context of COVID-19. So qualitative methods in AVID were seen to work effectively in virtual environments, with key informant interviews being conducted smoothly via video conferencing software in a number of the case studies, but also on virtual environments, with the India case study being able to apply really rich qualitative analysis to social media posts. And thirdly, a number of the AVID case studies are composed of transnational research teams, with research leads based in European institutions working with researchers based in the country of focus. And this is the makeup of many research projects in vaccine deployment. And so issues of positionality and power sharing have been really important for team members to reflect upon, especially as COVID-19 travel restrictions have also increased reliance on researchers working in country. And just one final learning to report has been that each of the case studies have described having to justify and even defend their use of qualitative and ethnographic methods at some point, be that to national or global policymakers, or even to fellow researchers from more quantitative disciplines. And so the need to really continue raising the profile of this work in the context of vaccine deployment research has been made clear. And what we hope really is that some of the outputs of AVID can contribute to this.
Yeah, thanks, Teresa and Megan. I think most of the learning on community engagement in epidemics is generally on larger studies like vaccine efficacy trials, or sometimes even more broadly, community engagement in the public health response itself, not even necessarily in health research at all. And so for us on this project to design community engagement strategies for 5 relatively smaller footprint anthropological studies, we developed some tools early on to help us think through each of the case studies' aims, objectives, methods, participants, who was burdened and who stood to benefit from the research, and use these tools to guide us in first defining community, and then secondly, designing fitting engagement strategies for each one. So for example, the India case study's use of social media analysis led us to think of engagement quite differently from the more geographically specific Sierra Leone case study's use of participant observation in the DHMT, the District Health Management Team in Cambia. And I think it showed us how adaptable community engagement approaches need to be, both to context, which we talk about quite often, but also to methods and to study design and how those dictate what communities are and how we ought to engage them.
Okay, so thank you so much, Mark. That's a really important point that you raise. So I wanted to talk about that further, but also talk more across the case studies, because there are clear similarities and learnings that apply across contexts. So one kind of general question following on from what you said, is what does it mean to engage communities, and what have you learned both for anthropological research and vaccine deployment more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that the pandemic has been so sort of tragically elucidating about is that existing social differences, marginalization, oppression, exclusion, conflict, histories of conflict, really matter in a health emergency. And that makes community engagement mission critical for vaccine deployment. Anxieties about these new vaccine products for new diseases are socially and culturally mitigated. And I think we risk the health and well-being of already marginalized groups if we don't center those lived experiences in the engagement strategies so that we empower rather than further marginalize these groups, groups like the Twa in the Congo or livestock farmers in Chamalibo, Uganda, or in the Brazil case study, pregnant women in Rio or in Sao Paulo. And if health research, particularly health research around vaccine deployment and emergencies, wants to participate in social justice or in health equity or contribute to those, then it has to deal directly with and be responsive to social injustice and health inequities. And I think community engagement is really our essential tool for achieving that.
So others can jump in if you want.
So to add to what Mark said, I think that's right, that community engagement, it typically gets thought of as more of an afterthought. And you start doing it once there's a problem or once you're rolling out the vaccine. But from all of our case studies, I think we've seen that there are issues and long existing problems within communities and their relationships with governments and the media and other groups that begin before that vaccine is being rolled out. So that was something that we were all quite attuned to in our case studies, that community engagement isn't this one-time thing that happens when you roll out a vaccine.
Yeah, if I can add on to that, I think that's absolutely right. And one thing that we've been really privileged with in the Sierra Leone case study, for example, has been sort of to be able to develop a long-term relationship with the public health office in Cambia, in Sierra Leone, which meant that we were able to kind of engage them as an audience and then think, you know, kind of work together and kind of co-produce the project and the framing of the project together, which then meant that we had some really fascinating conversations about what it might mean for them to do community engagement around vaccine deployment. And I think, as you know, as Sam has said, I think one of the most important things was that through that project and that collaboration and the work that then we did with the DHMT and community health workers to do research on vaccination in border areas in Sierra Leone, we were able to see that you can't just think about community engagement around vaccination as at the end point or at the point at which vaccines are delivered, but that communities have and community members have a lot to say and a lot to contribute all the way to thinking about all the steps of vaccine deployment, including sort of different deployment strategies, from simple things like deployment strategies that are matched to people's livelihood strategies and their everyday realities, to even more recently, we've been having some fascinating discussions about the ethics and justice of different prioritizations for COVID vaccines, for example. So I think that it's helped us through those conversations over a longer period of time to be able to kind of rethink for ourselves as well, and then together what it means to do community engagement around vaccines and how much more broadly can be conceptualized.
Thank you. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the point about prioritization that you just mentioned. Could you clarify?
Yeah, sure. We've been doing some focus group discussions. This is kind of parallel, so through all the different projects that we're running in Cambia with the Cambia DHMT. And we've been having discussions about people's ideas around how a COVID and also an Ebola vaccine might be best deployed. And so some of these discussions have really gotten deep into the kinds of debates that are happening all over the world at the moment as to who should be prioritized for a COVID vaccine in an emergency, for example, or any vaccine, depending on how on what the emergency looks like. And so, for example, in one part of the district, we had this conversation where, you know, younger people and older people in this village were having a debate about whether it should be which generation should be prioritized, with older people saying we've lived our life and maybe it's time, you know, younger people need to go to work and need to kind of have their lives and so on. Maybe they should be prioritized, but then broader discussions about whether actually older people are more vulnerable. So this, you know, kinds of discussions that have been happening in the UK, for example, or in Europe. And I think, at least from my perspective, it seems like it's rare to have those kinds of discussions as a public debate, and it would be important to, and I think community engagement can do that or should do that.
Thanks, Louisa. So another question I have is for all of you. It's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is vaccine equity. So of course, there's the equity issues between countries, but I think we've also seen equity within countries becoming an issue. So how can social science contribute to equitable vaccine deployment?
Thanks, Megan. I think this is an interesting question because obviously social science includes a lot of different disciplines. And what has been apparent in the COVID-19 pandemic is that there is a bit of a hierarchy in disciplines. And at the beginning of the crisis, epidemiologists were looked to, and also maybe the behavioral psychologists also as research and academic sources of insight. But we also think it's important to pay attention to other disciplines like anthropology and sociology, which has brought really detailed case studies and qualitative work into the picture, which I think was missing from the original disciplines that were drawn upon at the beginning of the pandemic.
So I think there are different roles for the social sciences, and I think what's really interesting about this project is that we're looking at the issue of vaccine deployment from quite different perspectives and kind of putting the lens on different issues. In our study in Sierra Leone, we're focused, for example, both on identifying social perspectives and experiences around vaccination, so maybe kind of broadly defined around confidence. Looking at deeper issues of trust, for example, and being able to put them in context. So understanding the political, historical, and socioeconomic factors that shape perspectives and experience of vaccination. I think because our project focuses on emergencies as well, in these kinds of situations, it's also important to think about the how the realities of crisis and crisis management and the structures that are put in place to respond to crisis also shape and reshape the social dynamics around vaccination. But through the Sierra Leone case study, we've also learned the importance of ensuring that we understand these perspectives and experiences of vaccination in the broader political and economic context. So looking at the broader political dynamics that I was mentioning before, and the sort of micro realities at district level that might influence kind of implementation and access of vaccination. And I think lots of the different case studies do that. And I think that another thing, and this links up to what we were saying about community engagement, is also that there is an important role for social scientists to work closely with different actors who make up the kind of landscape of vaccine deployment. So from people who are directly involved in immunization programs at national level, policymakers, emergency response workers, and so on, to kind of help them or discuss together, create spaces to think together about how citizens' voices and experiences might be taken more seriously, as Sam was saying, in the design of deployment strategies.
I think something that also comes up is whether there's time to do this in an emergency. And that's probably something we've all come across in our case studies, whether social science research is still a priority. And I think it's something that doesn't detract away from the emergency work that's happening. So I do believe that it's an important part of the research. And as long as we're aware of some of the limitations about that emergency situation, especially on, say, key workers or other people that we're engaging with, that's something that can work.
I think that also links to Mark's earlier point about this being, or community engagement being ongoing and not just at the time of an emergency. Do you see that as something that's feasible?
I think it is feasible, and it seems to be built on relationships within communities and also with the respondents and the government. So being quite well embedded in the situation that you're analysing and researching seems to promote that good community engagement.
Yeah, and that also helps then being able to respond quite quickly. I mean, you know, in Sierra Leone, for example, because through AVID we were doing the, you know, doing work with the DHMT when COVID happened, it meant that we were able to kind of turn around our project and kind of support some of the COVID response mechanisms that were being set up because we had those pre-existing relations as well. But just briefly also to say that I think one of the things that I've found and struggled with a bit, and it's made me think about this question that Sam is bringing up about emergencies, also about being able to, for us social scientists, to think about what findings or what kind of perspectives might lead to kind of quick findings that can be helpful for a response, and then kind of longer term structural issues that need to be taken into account but potentially can't be addressed directly, and being able to kind of think about how you feed those different types of social science perspectives into a response in a time of crisis.
I think that's right. You can't really do everything at once in that kind of situation, so you have to park some ideas and return to them later, but I think that doesn't exclude doing the work at the time.
No, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Great. So my next question is about collaboration within the research project and kind of the dynamics of the research team. So from your case study perspectives, how has the research benefited from engaging with experts on the ground and social scientists in country? And what do those collaborations look like in practice?
Okay, I'll go first with the Sierra Leone case study. We've had kind of a number of different types and kinds of relationships that have been really, really helpful and really kind of changed, I think, the way in which we've done research over the last few years. So partly, as I've already mentioned, the foundations of this project were really kind of through the 5 years of research that we've been doing in Cambia with the Ebola vaccine trial. So we have a team of social scientists there who are really kind of are continuing to work on the Ebola vaccine trials and a number of different projects. So their expertise has been really essential to kind of shaping some of the questions that we ask, and they've also kind of been involved in trainings and kind of doing feedback sessions with public health officials there. So I think that's been really beneficial in that sense. And then there have been two other kinds of relationships. So we have through the AVID project, we have two research assistants, and one has been doing ethnographic research in peripheral health units, Masire Fofana. And then we have Abbas Kamara, who's a surveillance officer normally at the DHMT. And so he's been doing sort of insider ethnography, let's say. So he's been kind of writing reflexive diaries about his experience doing epidemiological surveillance over the last couple of years inside the DHMT. And that's been, I mean, incredibly rich. And I think it's also been interesting to see how that's been shifting his own relationship to his own work at the DHMT. And then I guess thirdly and relatedly to that, it's our relationship with the district health management team. We've been really lucky to have a huge amount of support from the public health officials, from the district medical officer to the community engagement and immunization program officers, who've been really involved in kind of shaping our questions, thinking through with us about how findings can be fed back into their their strategies around sort of routine vaccination, but also COVID. So I think those collaborations, both with social scientists and public health officials at the district level, have been incredibly beneficial for even for everything in the research process, from how we've been asking questions to how we've been translating them into sort of response mechanisms and structures.
Yeah, and for the Brazil case study, the same as Luisa said, I think the case study also benefited from the fact that I have been conducting research in the country for a longer time than this. So I'm Brazilian, so I think that also made a difference here for this case study. But yeah, I think the fact that I had already had my network in the country and previous conversations with the people there at different levels, whether social scientists or government officials, I think that very much helped shape not only the project, but also the analysis and the thinking and kind of always having a finger in the pulse of what's going on in the country. I think that is very important too. So speaking to what Luisa just said about the importance of having the long-term research in the place that you're at and being embedded in the situation there, I think that's very valuable, not just for this project, but for social science projects per se.
And then for India, so for this case study, I did have a connection already with in-country partners. What was a bit different was I did find it was quite a slow start to try and understand what we could mutually get out of the collaboration. And that did take a lot more time than I'd expected. So we began by trying to learn about each other's research. But a turning point, I think, was when we had a round table where my collaborators in St. John's Research Institute in Bangalore invited a lot of their collaborators, which also included local activists, local health activists, NGO workers, and folk researchers. And I got a much better understanding about where their research directions were heading and what they hoped to get out of our collaboration. And that's now resulted in us working on a further joint project about healthcare workers' views on vaccination and particularly focusing on sanitation workers, which was their area of research before. And I think it does sound quite obvious that you want to find out what is mutually beneficial and how that collaboration works on an equal footing. But I think it also takes time to build that relationship if a project hadn't already begun and set out to do that. So that was really my learning from doing this work.
So with the Uganda case study, essentially I flew out before we began research to conduct qualitative data collection methods workshops with local NGO staff in Bwindi Impenetrable Forest. Now, this was for a couple of different reasons. One was to increase social science capacity in these areas, but it not only helped us with kind of the training of local community healthcare workers and veterinary technicians, because there weren't social scientists operating in the areas, but it also really helped us to refine the question set and kind of the methods of collecting data in these areas to see what was actually appropriate for the communities in which we were going to engage with. So together we worked to create scenario-based question sets that allow participants to relate better to, which kind of provided a greater level of feedback and in much more detail. And that was really due to the familiarity of the scenarios posed to them. And that came through the community expertise. That came through, especially working with the NGO Conservation Through Public Health, working with their vet techs, with their community health workers who were embedded within these communities, who knew these communities through and through and were very much trusted. Without that, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere near the level of detail that we have now got from conducting this research in these very, very remote areas of southern Uganda.
So during the 2018 Ebola outbreak in Congo, local social scientists actually told us that they had felt very overlooked and They hadn't been involved in the response and communication efforts, whereas sociologists and anthropologists and psychologists had been brought in from the capital, Kinshasa, and also internationally. And yet they often had really important observations to make. Some had been also conducting their own research, like a sociologist that I worked with from a local university in the city of Bandaka, who had been conducting his own research on the typical kind of communication efforts used by the response. So these very visual Ebola posters that would explain the symptoms of Ebola. And in fact, he found that many people had been misinterpreting these images. There was one, for example, where a person, it was supposed to depict a fever and a person was wrapped in a blanket. And what people had understood that to be was that if you had Ebola, then you could cover yourself in a blanket and steam yourself to relieve some of the symptoms and to help cure the disease. So his point was that these visual representations were being very misinterpreted by people who typically have a much stronger oral tradition, and that it would have actually been much more effective to be transmitting some of these messages through community leaders, through radio programs, but especially kind of from person to person, and especially through community leaders. And so as part of this project, what we tried to do was really involve very local, so not even, we worked closely with the Kinshasa School of Public Health, but also with very local social scientists. And we organized a capacity building workshop, and we tried to involve them in various stages of the research.
It seems like one of the overarching kind of themes coming through this work is the issue of trust and mistrust. So I wanted to ask, what is that context of trust or mistrust in health systems and political institutions? And what have you learned from your case studies about mitigating mistrust, especially during a disease outbreak?
So in Sierra Leone, I think that we were over a longer period of time kind of increasingly aware of the kind of many, many layers of trust and mistrust, and also how things are interconnected. So just to give you an example, one of the things that came out most strongly, especially from the work with community health workers and some of the border areas, was the really significant impact of mistrust or trust in the broader health system on people's perspectives on vaccination. And so, for example, community health workers' ethnographic work really highlighted how when they asked people why they might avoid vaccination appointments, for example, they would point not necessarily to the vaccination encounter itself, but actually how they'd felt the sort of humiliated and marginalized and excluded in other kinds of healthcare encounters with the peripheral health units, for example. And how this kind of perception of being excluded, or also, as I think Elise mentioned earlier, about, you know, not being able to afford healthcare when you feel like you should have access to quality healthcare, meant that people felt kind of generally alienated from the health system in general. I mean, I think that's just one example, and it's more complex than that. And there are kind of lots of layers. And I think some of these layers are also about how these kind of day-to-day experiences that build towards mistrust then also kind of sit on a much deeper kind of historical process as well of marginalization, of kind of perspectives also of foreign interventions and, you know, when we're thinking about emergencies and humanitarian responses as well. But also, as you say, about kind of trust in political institutions. When we've been talking to people about trust in vaccines, not only do they point to these kind of questions of the broader health system, but also just this kind of generalized mistrust in those in power at different levels. You know, and this kind of links to, as I was saying, kind of longer standing political histories. And as everybody's mentioned already, this is more kind of accentuated for certain social groups that are marginalized across different axes. And also so that you have this generalized mistrust and then also quite specific mistrust during an outbreak, for example, if politicians are seen not to be following the rules during a pandemic. That came up quite a lot during our COVID research, for example. And in terms of what we've learned about mitigating mistrust, I think that these kinds of approaches that contextualize feelings of mistrust kind of point both to kind of things that can be done on a daily basis that seem simple, like respect and kind of, you know, enhancing respect and kind of these everyday encounters, thinking about community engagement as two-way dialogue. But also these kind of much deeper structural issues that are harder to address, but it's important to put them on the table. And some of the conversations that we observed between healthcare workers and community members, for example, where these kind of constraints were acknowledged or these kind of histories of marginalization were put on the table, made a huge difference, even if they couldn't directly be addressed in that moment.
So trust was also a really important factor in the Uganda case study, specifically with regards to trust in government mandated culling campaigns, vaccination campaigns, and the kind of trust in the intentions of such campaigns were very much determined by whether or not farmers were seen as experts in their own rights, especially in the more rural areas of Bwindi and Chemelibwa. Now, this was typically, or based on our findings, as a result of kind of farmers' deep knowledge and affinity with their animals. They kind of possess their own in-depth, behaviorally orientated understanding of disease symptoms, which they also kind of apply to methods of controlling diseases, which is such as vaccines. Now, this is because for farmers, their knowledge of vaccines or infection control methods, they're kind of developed through their observations, through local knowledge, experience of other farmers, and from their limited interactions with veterinarians, veterinary technicians, and chemists. So a lack of trust in these techniques, such as culling, such as vaccines, are often measured by what farmers knew about the response and its observed effects. So in order to kind of increase trust in a vaccine rollout in these areas, we really need to respect that farmers are experts in their own rights, and they autonomously attempt to manage animal health and disease, and we need to respect that and work with them in order to kind of build trust. And that thing provides us with a gateway where we can begin to increase vaccine uptake by recognizing and responding to the way in which they do this, but also then increasing engagement and communication with regards to how vaccines can further benefit the health of their animals, but also themselves and their family members.
Thanks so much, Alex. So listening to you all, I'm really struck by the kind of deep, long-term social science work that you're doing that answers these big questions around political economy and trust and things like that. But I'm also struck by the immediate, quick, rapid, kind of real-time implications that your work has to inform vaccine deployment and administration. So Shelley, I think it would be great if you could wrap this up for us and bring it full circle. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on the future of this kind of work and the implications of this work for future vaccine deployment, including COVID-19 vaccine deployment.
Yeah, thanks, Megan. I think through our case study approach, we have shown the value of in-depth embedded social science research, and particularly approaches where we're working in a collaborative manner with the key stakeholders, with local researchers, and with communities. We've emphasized the importance of building trust and effective community engagement around our studies, and reflected how those approaches are important for vaccine deployment in itself. I think our case studies have shown the value of social science insights into barriers to vaccine deployment, which really focus on structural, social, and political barriers, and less on issues around community vaccine hesitancy. We would argue for sustaining this approach. We would like to see this kind of work embedded in the context that we work and in other contexts to ensure that social science research such as this is both sustainable and continues to inform preparedness for future epidemics and pandemics and recovery from current epidemics and pandemics. And rather than working in the ways that we have been asked to work as social scientists, which is during crises and bringing together our social science research in a rapid manner to address crisis, we really argue for a sustainable approach. I think one of the key issues that we have also discussed is how this the COVID-19 pandemic has revealed ongoing issues of inequity and injustice, both in public health responses to the pandemic, but also in the deployment of vaccines. And we would argue then that social scientists and the work that we do can take a strong political position to address these injustices and these inequity by providing empirical evidence for the impact of politics, economics, and history on vaccine deployment.
Thank you so much, Shelley, and thanks to the rest of your team for speaking with me today. And so we've come to the end of this episode. I'd like to say a big thank you to all of our contributors, Shelley, Louisa, Samantha, Alex, Clarissa, Lise, Mark, and Teresa. I hope we're leaving you with some new thoughts about what actions can be taken to optimize vaccine acceptance during a disease outbreak, particularly in light of different political economic contexts, histories of marginalization and mistrust. This leaves us with learning both for the COVID-19 pandemic and to rethink how vaccines are developed, trialed, and deployed both before and after a health emergency. Thanks for listening. And please check out www.sonar-global.eu for more about the network and for future podcasts.